The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. It is 1:07 p.m. and you're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. As usual, I'm Kingsley Kipuri and I'll be your host for the next hour. We'll be talking about things at home and abroad. Firstly, looking at the water crisis in the country. So looking at issues of drought and mismanagement and how all those things come together with consumption to create quite a tricky situation for South Africa's sort of water situation. We'll also be looking at what is being called an ecological crisis in Indonesia with the giant forest fires. In addition, we'll be looking at MTN Nigeria being fined $5.2 billion and what on earth is going on there. And we'll also touch on some of the EU migrant issues and what's going on with some of the sort of the continued millions of people moving into into Europe and the European Union and how that's being handled. I'm joined in studio by my esteemed colleagues, Greg Nicholson. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I'm disappointed to learn that the actual show went on without me when I wasn't here. I thought everything would just stop.
I mean, contrary to popular opinion that everything falls apart, we managed to get on okay. In part, and due to no small part, due to Fatima Mativa's excellent work. Fatima, welcome back again.
Hi, King.
So I want to actually start with you, Fatima, and you've been digging into the water stuff, you know, quite a bit. So, you know, Fatima, what's going on? I keep hearing water crisis. They say one place is water restriction, second place there's no. So what, could you just unpack for us what the water crisis actually is?
So, some of the key issues that are surrounding the water shortages are, first is the management of water. So there's a lot of issues with investment in repairing and maintenance, which is causing a lot of leakages in the system, which they call non-revenue water. And then there's the issue of behavioral issues, how people are consuming their water. And they've been trying to tackle that with a lot of campaigns. And then the last factor is, of course, the climate. So there's a decrease in rainfall in the country right now. And yeah, those are the three main issues, really.
I mean, yeah, I've been hearing a lot about it being sort of one of the driest periods in South Africa for a while. So we want to talk to somebody who knows more about this than I do. Kobus Olivier, prediction research scientist at South African Weather Service. Kobus, can you hear us?
Hi, yes.
Fantastic. Thanks for holding on. I know you've been there for a bit. Thanks for holding, Kobus.
Okay.
Perfect. Now, Kobus, I was talking about the sort of the water crisis in the country, what's being described as the water crisis. And we're being told that one of the contributing factors is the drought and the rainfall aspect. So could you just break that down for us? What's going on that front?
So most generally, for most of the country, we are experiencing dry conditions. Now, it's not some areas are getting some rain, but overall, we are experiencing dry conditions. And this is exaggerated by the previous season. There was also January dry, so some areas are actually in a drought situation where there was consecutive dry seasons, and we are expecting for most of the summer period that the dry and warm conditions will continue for most of the country, especially for the summer rainfall areas, the northeastern parts, which are currently in their rainfall season. We expect that to have quite a bit of an impact.
Okay, I mean, I hear you. I mean, we're hearing it's one of the sort of driest periods in the country's history. Is this, have we ever experienced this kind of this drought before, and how did that play out the last time?
So there's been numerous occasions where we've had dry conditions. Okay. What I have to remember is that in South Africa specifically, we go through a very big variability phases from year to year. Mm. So it's not uncommon for us to get dry conditions now and again, but in some cases, such as the 82-83 season, we had very dry conditions that impacted a lot of sectors. And it's difficult to say whether that we would have that kind of extreme impact in a forecasting sense, although we do expect some areas to get very dry conditions and probably drought conditions to occur.
Okay, so I'm just looking at a sense. So when you know, for me, sort of regular South African going around day to day sort of business, what do you think how dire is the situation basically? Is the word crisis apt? Is it at that point?
It could be. It's difficult from the Weather Service point of view, as those are usually more different sectors. The impact is on different sectors, so the agriculture and the water sources, water affairs would have more of an indication of how bad situation currently is. So we only know, you know, what the forecast and what the rainfall situation is. We're not entirely sure what the current water source and dam levels and the agricultural sector is, so we're more apt to talk to them specifically on how dire the situation is. Although, with regards to rainfall specifically, it is quite dry in a lot of areas, and the expectation is for a high likelihood of drier conditions to continue for most of the summer period.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's actually my next question. You say it'll continue for the rest of the summer period. Do you see it going on beyond that, or how long do you think this drought will continue?
So we only expect this to affect the current rainfall season that's in effect, so the summer rainfall areas, so the northeastern part. So we expect that to mostly go up to about March, April to have an impact. Not necessarily that it will have an impact on every month. The way the seasonal forecast, well, even our seasonal situations are in South Africa, is we get a distribution of rainfall throughout the season. So we might have certain months it's very dry, certain months might actually be quite wet. So that's just the reality of our seasonal distribution of rainfall in South Africa. So even though our forecast is for dry conditions throughout the summer, it does not mean that some months might actually be quite a bit wet.
Okay. I mean, I love that you mentioned sort of the national, and that this is sort of common to the South Africa area, because I mean, a lot of terms are being thrown around. People mentioning global warming, some people saying this is El Nino, and I think there's just a lot of confusion between these kinds of weather patterns. So could you just clarify that for us? What is the impact of global warming on this? How does El Nino play into this, if at all? Or is this just sort of regular South Africa's sort of weather pattern, and this is perfectly normal?
Okay, so global warming or climate change affects generally the change of the season as a whole very gradually over decades and decades. Mm-hmm. So you won't see the impact of global warming or climate change on one specific season. So as I mentioned, the biggest factor for us is this huge variation from year to year anyway, naturally, from regards to seasonal rainfall. So the biggest factor is what we call climate drivers. And one of those climate drivers is the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is in the Pacific Ocean. And this phenomena goes through different phases. You get an El Nino phase, or warming phase, or a La Nina phase, or cooling phase. And that impacts weather, or seasonal weather, across the globe. And for South Africa specifically, when there's an El Nino phase, it usually contributes negatively to our seasonal rainfall. But very importantly, only the summer rainfall areas, and not really anywhere else.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. And I mean, just before we let you go, I'd just like to understand, you mentioned before that as the weather service, you play a very specific role, and the government departments and so on play their own roles. And how do you use your data and your predictions and your research to inform how they make decisions on the water management side? So now, as you're doing your forecasting now, what is the relationship like, and practically what does it look like in how your number crunching and data forecasting plays into their sort of implementation?
So most of the departments we do have a relationship with them. So we produce our forecasts every month. So we provide updates every month. And for some departments, it's maybe a bit passive. For some departments, more active. For instance, for the agricultural sector, we do meet on a quarterly basis, where we provide them the forecast, and then they produce an advisory every month to be more specific to what farmers and agricultural sector should do given the forecast. So it's similar to other sectors as well. They would contact us, ask us what's the current information, and we would tell them. And they will then take that back and try and implement it in their systems.
Okay. Now, I'm going to push you here a bit, and I'm curious, what do you think of those different departments, especially the Department of Water and Sanitation, and their ability to act on your forecast? If you're saying you can anticipate this drought going until sort of March, April, what do you think of their ability to sort of handle the situation?
Well, it's going to be obviously difficult. If there's no rain, there's no rain. There's not much you can do, I assume. I guess just try and work around with what resources you have in certain areas. And if you can transfer. But it's obviously quite difficult. I obviously can't speak for them. I don't, not entirely sure exactly how their systems work. So, but it's going to be difficult. If there's no rain, it's going to be difficult to manage anything when there's not really much. So. But again, one needs to contact them and find out what the actual situation really is, and
I hear you. Thank you, Cobus. I know I put you on the spot a bit. We'll be speaking to the department shortly, and I'll make sure to pass on that question to them. Cobus Olivier, Prediction Research Scientist at the South African Weather Service. Thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. I mean, you heard it there, right? It's going to be dry until sort of March, April, and it sounds like, despite the sort of measured answers and sort of measured response, it sounds like it's clear from their side that it's going to be tough if it doesn't rain until then.
Sounds like something I think the public has to really start to consider and factor into in terms of our decision-making and how we use our own water.
I mean, yeah, Fatima, we talked about this the other day, about how there's been some attempt to actually change behavior in terms of consumption. And your comment was, why is that the case if sort of personal and household consumption isn't that big of a percentage of consumption? You were looking at the consumption stats, and what did you see as sort of the big trends in how the country consumes water?
Well, essentially, most of our water is consumed by agriculture, specifically irrigation. So it's a mixture of household irrigation and then irrigation in the agriculture sector. And that's 60% of our available water. So I was thinking, well, if about 10 to 15% is used by households, then what is my shorter shower going to change?
I mean, I think it's that tricky bit, because on one hand, you know, if you want to drastically reduce consumption of water, it makes sense to go to the agricultural sector. But I just assume that it's so tricky, especially if they're growing food, and then it affects food prices. If they're growing flowers or whatever and they don't have enough water, it affects exports. So I imagine it's easier to sort of turn to us and just say, guys, just, you know, take shorter showers. I imagine that's sort of the way to go.
Exactly. You look like you're actually doing something.
I mean, that's a bit cynical. Greg, I'm curious for your point of view. I remember you mentioned before that you've seen an effective sort of water management process before on the consumption and behavior change side, living in Australia and there being sort of water issues, and seeing how a government-sponsored behavioral change process on weather, on water consumption at household level can actually sort of work.
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm from Melbourne, which is in the state of Victoria in Australia, and I think we went through droughts for a bit over a decade, and the water shortages in the dams were getting worryingly low, and those you know, ever-shortening periods of how long we could last on the current predicted rainfall, and it was getting quite dire. So the government led a program on to avoid water wastage, and it's hard for me to say how effective it was, but because the dams continued to get lower and lower as the rain just didn't come. But they had sort of all sorts of national campaigns, or at least statewide campaigns that I saw, about, you know, getting your leaky taps fixed. And it sort of showed you in, you know, in stickers and billboards how much, you know, how many buckets of water one leaking tap can create a single day, and where that water is just wasted. You know, little kids at school, you learnt about if you brush your teeth, you make sure you turn off the tap while you brush your teeth, things like that. We had those little hourglass timers sent out to almost everybody in different neighbourhoods that you're supposed to stick in your shower, and it measures a 4-minute shower. Excuse me. And then there were other systems in place where we had water restriction in terms of, you know, you can only wash your car with a bucket of water rather than using your hose. Or if you want to water the lawns, you can only do it between certain times of day. Mm. All these sorts of things like that that I think just mobilize society to help save water. The long-term solution for Melbourne, at least at that stage, was the creation or the establishment of a desalination plant where they could get salt water and it would be processed and turned into drinkable water. By the time that was finished and the billions were spent, the drought was over. But it, you know, I think the world actually everybody has to go through these different stages, and desalination plants are quite popular in some parts of the Middle East, and I think it's just a global problem now where we have to all look at, and different countries, just look at how water can be saved and how we can get creative ways of finding more usable and drinkable water.
Yeah, I'm not sure, like, the world, I know it's, you know, saying the world as one sort of reference term is quite silly, but...
But it is quite, it's quite common.
Yeah, I'm not sure people have realized that, just how scarce a resource water is.
Or is becoming, at
least. Or is now becoming, and that we will just fundamentally all have to change our behavior. And sure, the agricultural and industry will need to move along too, But imagine if every single person fixed their leaky tap and took shorter showers and was careful about when they washed their cars or where they washed their cars or how they washed their clothes. I imagine that a tremendous amount of water could be saved just from that.
I think so. I don't think it's going to save the long-term, you know, if there's long-term drought, I don't think it's going to completely save you. But obviously, that will, if you save some water, that's going to, you're going to, the water you have will last longer and go further.
And I hear you. I mean, we are just trying to get a hold of the Department of Water and Sanitation. And, you know, I'm hoping we'll be through to them soon. Now, their big focus is on the repairs and maintenance side, right? So leakage, as Fatima, you mentioned, leakage is a big problem. And we have, and you'll see it, you know, just driving up and down. You'll see a pavement flooded or you know, just basically government or our public water, you know, going to waste. Fatima, you, during your research, you mentioned something called the War on Leaks program. That sounds quite intense. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So it's a project that's being done by the Department of Water and Sanitation, and it was actually mandated by the president, who spoke about it in his speech. And what they're doing is they're training unemployed youth to address issues of maintenance and repairs.
I mean, they mentioned that skills shortage is actually a big problem, and just looking at some of the department materials, it's almost as if they're saying, we intend on taking action on this, we intend on executing on this war on leaks, but we just don't have enough skilled people as civil engineers and so on, and I suppose that ties back to some of the education issues we've been having as a country. And there's some kind of partnership, I think, with, is it the Danish government? There's some kind of partnership with trying to resolve that aspect.
Well, it wasn't specifically for the issues of repair and maintenance, just generally about water management. So that was announced, I think, yesterday. They signed a memorandum of understanding, and it's a collaboration with the South African government and the Dutch government, and what they're trying to do is learn from the lessons of the Dutch government on how to manage water.
If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're talking about a bunch of things, including the water crisis in South Africa, ecological crisis that's happening in Indonesia, MTN being fined $5.2 billion in Nigeria, amongst a host of all other things. Remember, you can join the conversation on @DMShowZA on Twitter. You can also call in on 0861-555-8589. Now, I want to talk quickly about the Fees Must Fall movement that's been happening over the past couple of weeks. It's really been dominating the headlines. We had two shows on it, so we didn't want to do a whole third show on it. I'm sure listeners are probably getting fed up of hearing me talk about it for the whole hour. But just in the interest of closure, I'm curious about where we are now. Greg, you've been following this still quite closely. And, you know, there was a shift in focus from that to outsourcing. Some people were happy with the no fee increase in 2016, some people weren't happy about it. Where are we with all this?
Well, I think where we're at now is, since President Zuma made his announcement that there would be no fee increases across universities in 2016, we saw some universities sort of be satisfied and sort of end the protests, and other universities continue on the protests but shifting onto other issues. One of the key issues, well, I think the few key issues, were an end to outsourcing, so an end to universities going through outside companies to get them to do services such as catering, cleaning, maintenance, and so on, as well as commitments for other sort of fee-based systems, like to have a limitation of the registration fee for next year, things like fights against supplementary exam fees, and so on and so on as well. As the broader goal of getting a commitment towards a path, I guess, towards free education. And what we saw, I think, at the different varsities is some of them were split. You know, some students seemed happy with the no fee increase announcement by Zuma and then said, you know, it's time to get back to our exams, it's time we study. And a continuation of protests might now put our future careers at jeopardy. Whereas other students wanted to continue the protest, particularly on the point of solidarity with workers, as workers stood with students in their protest against fees, many students thought, now we have to stand with workers against outsourcing. And I think it was quite impressive the amount of students who did continue protesting, and even after this sort of thing sort of seemed resolved, and, you know, sort of what more can you do, many of them now have managed to get quite significant achievements at many universities, so such as like UCT, at WITS. You know, these guys have committed to engagements to end outsourcing, and it looks like they're starting the path towards hosting mostly insourced workers. We've seen commitments such as the University of Johannesburg for a focus on a more African-orientated curriculum, where they're introducing, you know, things like African philosophy, post-colonial movements, colonial struggle movements, as compulsory subjects for all undergraduates. And that's been a big topic, particularly since the Roads Must Fall issues came up earlier in this year, and just changing the sort of the learning systems and the orientation of the curriculums. And so I think even after the fees were announced to be lower by Zuma, we have seen this sort of smaller amount of protesters achieve some really significant gains. And in the last few days, we've seen most universities resume studies, and now they're preparing for exams. I think the University of Western Cape is one exception, where today the Vice Chancellor, I think, is meeting students, and there have been continued sort of protests disrupting the attempts to reopen the university. But I'd imagine soon that would also, those protests will also end.
So I suppose my feeling is it, are we happy? Is it sort of 100% as a sort of supporters of the students and the Fees Must Fall movement? Are we basically good to go? Have we won?
I think the students have won. Mm-hmm. If you're a supporter, I think you should be quite happy with some of the gains made, because I don't think anyone expected them to not only achieve the freeze on fee increases nationally for next year, but to make significant advances against issues like outsourcing. Because people, so if you take WITS for example, yeah, which is, you know, probably closest to us here, yeah, in Johannesburg, there have been protests against outsourcing from students and staff for years. It's been going on for ages. You know, if you drive past WITS, you'll regularly see this small group of protesters, you know, one of the entrances or something like that. But little advances were made by those protests. And then for these student movements currently to use the momentum in the fees process to then actually make significant gains on issues like outsourcing, I think they should be heartened by those issues. And then also I think you can be heartened in the, if your aim is to, over the long term, create more accessible and more affordable quality education, I guess, on the road to perhaps free education, yeah, or free education to the, yeah, poor, for the poor, or whichever sort of way you want to define it that fits into more accessible quality education for more South Africans, then I think there's been major advances made. And I think this current movement and this current sort of wave of demonstrations across the country has completely shifted the discourse, and it has completely forced all of the political parties and all government officials to start asking the question, okay, how can we implement or make change policies so that education can be more affordable and better for students across the country? And I think they've really put that on the agenda.
I mean, fantastic. I'm just, you know, heartened just hearing about all this. We heard so much from the naysayers who said, you know, stop causing trouble and just go back to school, stop delaying everything. You know, students want to sit exams, and it's really great to see that, you know, that a committed group of young people, you know, in modern-day South Africa can actually make this kind of change happen. If you're just tuning in, it's just after 1:30, the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're just about to switch topics and talk about MTN being fined in Nigeria. We'll be talking to the West African editor of the Africa Report, Tolu Ogunlesi, to give us some more on that. Tolu, can you hear us?
Yes. Hello, Tolu? Hello. Hello. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. Tolu, thanks for making time for us at such short notice.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, perfect. So, Tolu, the first question is, I'm sitting here and I hear $5.2 billion. I'm amazed. What on earth could MTN have done to be accused, yeah, of, you know, a crime worth of that kind of punishment? What are they accused of having done?
Well, so, yeah, you know, when you look at the figure at face value, $5.2 billion is a lot of money. Mm. It's actually even more than what MTN makes in Nigeria, which is the biggest market, and almost half of what it makes overall in revenues annually, at least last year.
Mm.
But there's a method to the madness. I mean, if one looks at it. So there's a document From 2011, that the Nigerian Communications Commission, which is a regulator, which imposed the fine, there's a document that stipulates a 200,000 naira fine per SIM card that the telecoms companies fail to deactivate. That's the unregistered SIM card.
Mm.
You know, so this document, so there's a document from 2011 that spells out that fine. You know, it's not, the fine was not, it's not, it's not, so in that sense, it's not an arbitrary fine.
Okay.
But what has happened this time is that the regulator has then decided to impose that fine on the 5 million cards that MTN was accused of not deactivating. You know, so this is the first time that's happening. Before now, they have been fined, but the fines have been on smaller smaller numbers of SIM cards.
Mm.
So MTN paid 102 million naira. About last month or the month before, August, September. You know, so that was a fine for a smaller number of cards. What the NCC has done now is to fine them the maximum possible fine. You know, which then explains why it's $5 billion now.
Wow. I mean, some analysts looking at it are saying that this recently, because as you say, this has been there since 2011, and some say this has now become a sort of move from a regulatory issue to a national security issue, and there was even a kidnapping in the mix. Could you tell us about the kidnapping and how it affected the telecoms industry?
Okay. Yes. So the whole purpose of the NCC insisting that the SIM cards must be registered is because, you know, a lot of crime happens in Nigeria, you know, I guess as in many other parts of the world as well, that is aided by mobile phones. So kidnappings, for example, you know, a kidnap happens and then to ransom negotiations take place by phone. Now, when the SIM card does not have any identifying information, it's not registered to any name, then it's easier for people to use them, you know, to commit crimes. Fraudsters, and all sorts of people. I mean, even in the Northeast where Boko Haram, you know, the insurgency is going on, the cards have also been implicated in the insurgency, because then the terrorists use them to communicate. And there's no data on the SIM card to identify ownership. So the government has, which is why the government then decided in 2011, you know, that we need all cards must be registered. What happened was in September there was a kidnap of a former Nigerian finance minister, and the NCC now says that the SIM card that was used to conduct ransom negotiations was an MTN card, and also that they found with the kidnappers a lot of MTN cards that were not registered. So I think that the high profile nature of that kidnapping, I think, was what pushed the government to decide that, look, we must make a move that shows that we're not kidding about this getting this SIM card registered and the registered ones deactivated. So that's how the kidnapping comes in. But another point to make is that the government has given deadlines before now. There have been several meetings between the government and the telecoms company, you know. And it wasn't only MTN that was defaulting, actually. Until about August, all of the four major telecoms companies were defaulting, you know. But the NCC says that the other companies have made moves and have complied fully, and have completely deactivated all SIM cards that are not registered, leaving MTN as the sole offender.
Wow, I think MTN was just sort of calling the government's bluff, and I think they called it correctly until now, and then, you know, this kidnapping, and it seems like they're the ones caught with their pants down.
Yeah.
I mean, totally...
Oh, yes. The kidnap was a funny point.
I mean, totally, there's another sort of angle that's being some people are pointing towards and saying that the Nigerian sort of government is in trouble financially, and, you know, oil prices are dropping,
yeah,
or have dropped rather, And that, you know, and a lot of the government's revenue comes in from the sale of oil. So people are saying what they're actually doing is using the fines and finding large companies and using that to supplement the lost revenue from oil prices. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, to be honest, at face value, it seems to be a sensible, logical argument.
Yeah.
Nigeria's revenues, oil prices have fallen significantly. They are half of what they were in 2014, for much of 2014. And so, yes, the government is in need of money. But when you put the context, which I've explained earlier, that context makes it difficult to justify the argument that the government is doing this to raise money. You know, again, you know, if the government was doing it to raise money, it would be a particularly foolhardy government that would impose that kind of fine to raise money, you know, when MTN is one of the biggest taxpayers and one of the highest revenue earners in the country. You know, so I personally don't think there's any evidence to suggest that the government did this to shore up dividend revenues.
Mm.
If the government wanted to shore up dividend revenues, I don't think MTN would be the target. You know, there are oil companies that, I guess, you know, you could easily move against oil companies, which have access to bigger revenues.
Mm.
You know, which would be in a better position to absorb those kind of fines. So I don't think that the government did to show up revenue. $5 billion is a lot. Is a quarter of the Nigerian budget, of the federal government annual budget, and so it will also actually hurt investor confidence if the government was going after the biggest companies because it wants to show up doing revenue. I think the context, which is that this same deactivation conversation has been going on for four years. You know, I think that context explains suggests that the argument of showing up dividend revenue is not accurate.
I mean, I hear you. I think my thing is, like you said, it's been going on for 4 years. There's repeated conversations between the regulators and MTN about this, so it's hard to pretend now to be surprised. I mean, how do you think, you've mentioned some things like investor confidence, and I'm curious about regional relations. How do you think this might, I mean, there's been issues between Nigeria and South African governments in the past. How do you think this plays into that sort of regional powerhouse relational or relationship between the two countries? Do you think this negatively affects that by any chance?
Yeah. Well, you know, quite unfortunately, it's a bit unfortunate that this is happening at this time because, you know, the two countries are just attempting to mend the relationship that has, you know, quite frankly, been in tatters.
Mm.
Former President Jonathan, who handed over in May, under him, his final months in office, the relationships between Nigeria and South Africa were quite poor. And on the basis of a couple of incidents. So first there was the synagogue church collapse in Lagos, in which more than 80 South Africans died. You know, the South African government felt that the Nigerians did not handle the issue properly. It took many months for the bodies to be sent back home, you know, and all that. So there was that. And there was, of course, also the issue of the $9 million of Nigerian funds seized at the airport in South Africa. And the issue of the mercenaries hired, the South African mercenaries hired by the Nigerian government. So all of these issues, a year ago actually, so this was late last year, all of those issues significantly damaged the relationship between Nigeria and South Africa. So at this point, this is the time when, you know, with the movement in Nigeria, they're only just starting to build back the two biggest economies on the continent. So it's unfortunate that you now have this issue that suggests that the Nigerian government is targeting a South African business.
Mm.
It's going to definitely affect the repair of the relations that I talked about. It's not the best time, you know, for this to happen. So I just hope that both countries are going to manage this, not give into conspiracy theories. You know, that they are going to manage this at the highest levels and make sure that they are both speaking the same language and not operating, you know, in an atmosphere of suspicion and speculation.
I mean, I hear you. I think that's the best we can hope for. And, you know, let's be honest, the whole continent benefits if South Africa and Nigeria get along. Tolu, thank you so much for making time.
My pleasure.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Tolu Ogunlesi, West African editor of the Africa Report, just breaking down what's going on with MTN being fined $5.2 billion in Nigeria. Doesn't sound like there's any foul play there. I think it's simply a matter of the rules are the rules. And MTN called the regulators bluff for a while correctly and then not so correct anymore.
Investors must have been freaking out yesterday.
I can imagine. They stopped the trading of MTN shares for a while. There was a rumor that MTN had paid over the money, which if you're making, you know, I think it's $2 billion a year they're making. Imagine reports that you paid over $5 billion in about 24 hours. Mm. So you can imagine what investors are thinking without consultation of investors. Anyway, if you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're just going into the last 15 minutes of the show. And I want to switch, Greg, to something you've been looking at quite keenly about the forest fires in Indonesia and what's being described as an ecological disaster. Mm. What's going on?
Well, we haven't heard too much news about it, really, but it's intense. If you just look at the photos and the numbers, you've got sort of cities and whole sort of regions just colored in this sepia sort of haze from the smoke fires. And like to just drop some of the numbers for you, just to show sort of the scale of how intense this thing is. Mm. There's an estimated 127,000 fires burning in forests across different islands of Indonesia. And that sort of land on the land, the scale of three times the size of Singapore, about the size of New Jersey. It's mostly in Sumatra and the Indonesian side of Borneo, and that covers tens of thousands of hectares. So if we want to talk about the impact and sort of what that means when you're burning this sort of land.
So is it fair to say that most of Indonesia is covered in forest fires?
Not most, but Indonesia is a very big place with many, many, many islands, but a lot of it, quite a lot.
Okay.
And so if you're talking about sort of what the impact is, you know. So far they estimate that 19 people have died due to related respiratory illnesses. Mm. 500,000 have got acute respiratory infections. The visibility in some parts of Indonesia is now at 50 meters because the haze is so thick. Mm. You can only see 50 meters ahead of you. There's something like, so if you're talking about the environmental impact, not only has it affected, you know, areas of Borneo that have such a high sort of biodiversity around there, there's been 16 million metric tons of carbon is being released a day. That's more than the US, which has an economy 20 times as big as Indonesia's. And so in 3 weeks, these fires have released more CO2 emissions than Germany does in one whole year.
Jesus.
It's insane, right? And so it's largely because the sort of the peatlands, like this land that why so much carbon is coming out is because it's extremely rich in carbon. And there's the sort of peatlands here. And so when it burns hotter and it burns for longer. And it just sort of really burns for a long time and really releases a lot of these gases come up from the ground. And the same reason for that, why they're burning it, it is because these peatlands are also extremely good for growing palm oil and sort of pulpwood plantations.
Jeez, I'm really just struggling to comprehend all the physical size and the scale of the kind of...
It's insane. Three times the size of Singapore.
Of the damage it's doing to the planet. And I suppose my next question is, how did it start? How does a fire this big start or get going or keep going?
It's fascinating actually how it started and how it's actually still going, because it seems that for a while, Indonesia has a practice of... Mm. So these... palm oil plantations, you know, quite big money in Indonesia. Indonesia is the biggest manufacturer of palm oil, which is used in a whole host of different products. And at the sort of local level, so some people say it's big business is the fault. Some people say it's sort of media mafioso sort of type of business and who are linked with local politicians. Mm. But the key thing of what's going on, and this has been happening for a long time in Indonesia, is people and businesses are burning forest land that they hope will basically clear the land and then they can use that for plantations, right? And this time, it's been going on for years, but this time it seems it's gone a lot longer, a lot more extensive, and done a lot more damage. So the short of it is that political sort of business opportunists with potential corrupt and political connections are just trying to burn forests so they can make money off a palm oil plantation.
Jeez, and it just got out of control.
Mm-hmm. And then because, like back to the earlier topic that Fatima was talking about, you know, with the weather patterns around the world now, El Nino, we have, sorry. We're talking about the pronunciation before we started, it got into my head, and now I think I messed it up.
So we had probably like a 20-minute argument about how to pronounce El Nino and what the little squiggle on top of the N is. So that's us.
I knew, and now because I took the wrong side in the argument just to be contradictory, now I'm messing it up.
I mean, Greg, you also studied Indonesian for 10 years, so I think you got the upper hand on us.
I did, but luckily it's not an Indonesian word, so. But so because of the heat patterns, and normally what would happen in this sort of circumstance when they have these fires, because they often have them around this time of year in the dry season, you know, eventually the sort of torrential rains come, the monsoons come. But this year, because it's been so dry, they haven't come till later. So in the sort of last few days, it seems to have eased off slightly, only very slightly, where there have been some rains. But because it's been so dry with the weather patterns around the world, these fires have just been able to continue and to continue.
I mean, it's really sounds completely out of control, and I'm also making a lot of assumptions about the Indonesian government's ability to now contain and put it out. So what's been the response locally in the country, politically, internationally? Are people rushing to help put it out or at least contain it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the country's been holding prayers for rain. That's, you know, a starting point, but not sure how effective that is. But what we did see is the Indonesian President Joko Widodo, he was actually in the United States on a visit over there. He cut short his trip to come back to Indonesia. He hasn't yet declared a national emergency, but six provinces have declared emergency, and that the president has deployed, I think it's like 30 aircraft and something like 22,000 troops who are now on the ground trying to fight off these fires, and as well help and evacuate victims where need be. There's also been assistance from Malaysia, I think Singapore, Australia and Japan, who are, you know, providing things like firefighting helicopters that can drop large amounts of water over these fires. But in effect, without the rain, I think it's extremely difficult to really target these fires that have become so widespread right now. You know, it's extremely hard to control fast burning fires that can switch in different ways in the wind, and when there's so many of them across so many different islands of Indonesia.
I mean, there's really so much to say. It really just sounds like a complete disaster, and the response sounds pretty slow. If the country is still yet to actually declare this what it is, you know, how can we expect other countries to, you know, to respond adequately?
I think so. There are some articles, you know, suggesting that the world's media have failed on this issue.
Yeah, that's actually my next question. I suppose it's we, right? As the media, are we failing or not reporting enough about this? Does it matter if we reported more about this?
Well, here we are. Here we are right now.
I mean, I'm not sure if Obama's listening in to send in the...
Well,
you know.
I think for a few reasons it might have gone unnoticed for a while. Number one, because it's a common occurrence in Indonesia. Every year there are such fires, and because of the, I guess, nefarious sort of links, you know, these are guys trying to profit off the land. You know, it's these dodgy guys, and they do it all the time sort of thing. I think people overlooked it for a little while. So that's one reason it went underreported for a while. Another reason is because Indonesia, despite its size, you know, I think it's one of the sort of the most populated countries in the world. Despite its size, it doesn't assume a large presence in the international media. It gets overlooked for, you know, largely Europe and North American, you know, it's just sort of like everywhere. It's sort of like a lot of African issues too. But Indonesia is often much bigger than a lot of other countries that still get attention. But we don't focus on the issues even so deeply. Even in Australia, where, you know, Indonesia is Australia's neighbour, Indonesia has huge influence in the region, yet the Australian media largely ignores Indonesian issues, and there's still such a misunderstanding from Australian side of Indonesian issues and Indonesian politics, just because of, I think, our biases in terms of what we want to know about and what we think is important.
And I hear you. It's not like this, really. I mean, I'm actually just getting depressed. Well, but, you know, sorry about this.
Just to depress you a little bit more.
Let's hear it.
I think they were saying something like one third of the world's orangutan population is at risk. Because, you know, when you've got some of these areas around Borneo and Sumatra, that's key areas, you know, for orangutans. And we're not sure exactly of the sort of the danger to the ecology and animals yet. But people like Greenpeace is doing a lot of work on this, and they're saying it's dire. It could be really, really dire.
I mean, we'll, I suppose, try to find if there's some aid organizations perhaps that are diverting attention in that direction, and we'll see if we can maybe tweet some links to how to actually help out, even if it's just donating money or raising awareness, you know, just so not to feel like we're sitting here in Rivonia just, you know, talking shop about this. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm sitting here with a very depressed Greg Nicholson and Fatima Matiba. Just going to the last few minutes of the show.
I think there's another depressing topic, right?
There we go. Of course, the migrants moving into Europe and how that's especially being handled. Now, Greg, I'm especially interested in your perspective on this because you were actually in Germany a couple of weeks ago for the sole purpose of looking at of how the migrant crisis, as it was being called at some point, is being handled, especially in Germany. So I'm really curious as to your sort of first-hand experience of what things are like on the ground. If you could just walk us through just that whole experience.
Okay, first of all, I think from a South African perspective, I'm not sure if we understand how much of the public attention and the news it's assuming in Germany.
Yeah.
When I was there, and still, from what I'm reading lately, it still seems to be, it is the one issue. Every day I was in Berlin, it was on the front cover of basically every newspaper. And for Germans, many of them do view it as a... Even whether you support the welcoming of refugees or you don't, there is a strong sense that this is a crisis that... Not necessarily from government side, of course, because, you know, they're obviously they don't particularly want to use the word crisis, but there is a strong sense that this is really the issue of the time.
Okay.
That in Germany, without a doubt, it's the issue of this year. It's overshadowed, you know, earlier in the year we had Greece's financial crisis.
Yeah, the EU financial issues are what is Germany going to bail everybody out?
That's been washed away, you know. It's still a huge issue, obviously, in the EU and in Germany, but it's been washed away by this so-called migrant crisis. It's overwhelming in Germany. It's just, I think in terms of the numbers that of people that are coming in a day into Germany seeking asylum seekers, it's something like 8,000 plus. Every single day arriving at Germany's borders. Mm-hmm. They haven't seen this sort of migration since World War II. And the most recent, I think, they saw was, you know, when in the early 90s, when the former Yugoslavia broke up. And they did take in huge amounts. I think that year maybe they took in 450,000 people in terms of migrants. It was a spike. But in this year, they're talking about over a million refugees. It's incredible.
Jeez, and I was reading an article the other day, and they were sort of, I think it was The Economist or something, and they were praising Germany's flexibility at dealing with this and how they've tried to integrate these people into communities and into schools, and the general trend there was that despite crazy conditions, and that Germany at least is doing pretty well. Was that your sort of assessment on this?
Yeah, well, I think we have to remember one of the key things is that Germany is a very rich country. And the culture of German organization and efficiency is, you know, often true.
Yeah.
They are very well planned and well organized. So I can run you through a little bit of what happens to the asylum seekers when they get there. So often, you know, you travel quite a long route, you know, sort of through, you might have even walked through some of sort of the Balkans, through some of Eastern Europe to get to Germany. And then by the time you arrive in Germany, what happens is sort of, so you might come in through Bavaria, sort of through Munich, and then... Because Munich can't handle at the moment all of these huge influx of refugees, they'll probably put you on a train to Berlin or one of the other places, or some will get processed in Munich, then you go to these other places. And so then you might arrive in Berlin, where I met some of these asylum seekers, and there you'll get... I think German society has been quite... some of German society has been quite strong in rallying around and providing support for these refugees. So you might sort of go to like a... like a city mission or one of these sort of holding, you know, sort of places where they can accommodate you for a day or two. And then what you do there is while you can, you know, get a bed there for the night, then, and they're trying to open up all sorts of places for that, sort of like sporting stadiums, you know, school gyms, sporting fields, all sorts of anywhere where they can have beds to lean, you know, to have people sleep on. And then you go to the processing center to where you can, you know, submit your application for asylum. And that's where I think things are falling down a little bit now. First of all, the resources are just around, okay, how do we house all of these people? How do we provide water, food, shelter? And how do we have the administrative capacity to process, you know, when there's something like 8,000 people coming in a day? It's an intense sort of administrative capacity that's needed. And there, that's getting a little bit, I think that's where some Germans are saying it's a bit of a crisis. So I went, there were guys who'd been coming back every single day for 20 days or something to this sort of processing center. So you submit your form, or, you know, you have a short interview at the start, And then you know you come back every day with a number, waiting for your number, your number one down, whatever, to be called. And then after that, as you're getting processed, you'll get located in an area around Germany somewhere, and you get housed in sort of old office space or all these sort of different temporary solutions. And I think it's after a few months you're able to work and learn German. That's so they have a policy of integration in Germany, but that means trying to help you find work. Yeah. And also trying to get language skills. So that's sort of the key thing as to what's going on. But on all those steps, Germans are really struggling to continue to meet the demand because it's just intense. But so Chancellor Angela Merkel has been praised for refusing to close down the borders and refusing to put a limit on how many refugees will come into the country a year. The problem is there's deep divisions in Germany. You know, there are the conservative and or sort of right-wing racist parties or people are, you know, trying to rally around this, talking, Germany's a Christian country, right? So they're saying these Muslims coming in, terrorists, how do we know, whatever. But even, you know, her own party and in Merkel's own party, there's been lots of division. And right now, actually, currently, there's intense debate as to how to proceed and how to handle this thing. So I can talk a bit about the potential solutions because Germany can't cope with this forever. But
yeah, I mean that's like we've got just a bit of time left. You've just run us through that.
Yeah, so a few things, some of the brief things. Germany's tried to they've rushed through this law to sort of basically say no to anyone from who they deem safe countries. So these are places like Macedonia. I think Ghana was even thrown in there too. You know, so if you turn up and you're from Ghana, bad luck. Basically, you know, where there's been some debate about that. But so you cancel out the guys who. We were unlikely.
Okay, so I can just sneak in, basically.
Kenya might still, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if Kenya is still, you know, with the refugee camps up north and whatnot. Maybe Kenya could still. Yeah. Then also, but the thing is, it has to be a European solution. That's okay. The challenge. How can Europe share the number of migrants, and how can Europe also find a way to collectively protect their borders without having fences everywhere and having some sort of, you know, concentration camp system, which obviously Germany would be quite shocking to see any sort of system of these camps in Germany considering its history.
Greg, thank you. I know we squeezed it to the last 30 seconds there. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. It's a daily
I can talk
habit.
More if you want. So I can
unfortunately, we're literally getting kicked out.
Duncan's
of the
yelling at me.
There we go. Thank you for tuning in. It's a Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. Please download the podcast, share it far and wide. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.